Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. The first case on our calendar is 00903, Michelle Mannion versus Alan Sindel. Mr. Michelson. Time there in the clock.
We trust that the court has reviewed the briefs and the material. We feel that the briefs and supporting material are very descriptive of our position in the case. My purpose is primarily to answer questions or clarify anything that the court feels is unclear, and of course to respond to any arguments. I wasn't sure which court this court meant, but I think it meant the Court of Appeals. Were they saying they have a somewhat different standard on this issue? I'm not sure what they said.
The case in the Court of Appeals reported case.
Yes. It seems to be consistent with all of the other reported cases that we've ever found, and we have not found anything contrary to that. That's why this decision is so inexplicable, because it goes, in our view, it goes in the face of their own holding, which is that
they did seem to rely on a prior case of their own.
It appears to us Winston is the case, and the Winston case seems to say rather clearly what they're obligated to do, which is consistent with the Antel case and consistent with what this court and every other court that meets them. So I can't explain the opinions.
The only real issue before us is whether or not it was proper to grant the new trial, and when it was granted, whether or not the reversal is proper. That's all that's before us, isn't it?
Basically, we articulate the reasons, the issues as, number one, did the trial court fulfill its obligation to articulate enough information to allow appellate review? And if you did not, then the solution ought to be a remand and not entry into the verdict. Seems to me that's the issue.
You're saying remand, but you mean remand from the Court of Appeals to the trial court for that purpose. It's not in the trial court or the Court of Appeals anymore. It's here.
Yes.
What if we reverse?
Then it should be remanded to. If we reverse,
yeah.
Or a new trial.
Well, or should the Court of Appeals articulate the proper standard?
Well, we believe that all the cases. I mean, it seems to me it's
yeah, I understand the law.
No, I understand
the procedure.
It seems to me it's a vain act to do anything other than to send it back for a new trial. I mean, we can go up and down the appellate systems to say what is fairly clear in the law and uncontroverted. I don't know. We would send it back to the Court of Appeals from here. I don't know why, other than
to tell them to remand it so they get the proper standard, if that's the proper standard's the issue, so they understand the proper standard for the next case. If we just send it right back to the trial court and say the standard was this, the Court of Appeals decision is still there, even though it's reversed. That may be a difference.
I suppose that's one method to do it, just take a little longer. Seems that a court's opinion here would explain what they were supposed to do in the first place, consistent with their own case, which was from 1984, and that would give them the guidance and the bar the guidance necessary. The trial judge should be the guidance necessary. I think what they're asking here is the logical conclusion is that the Court of Appeals is themselves or this court is now being asked to adopt a unique theory for trial courts ordering a new trial or the verdict against the way the evidence. And there's nothing that I can find that we find anywhere that supports that. And that is that the trial court must articulate not only sufficient reasons for his decision or her decision, but also must comment on every element of every claim in the entire case before the appellate court can review. It seems that that's a burden that this court, the appellate courts, no court, is prepared to.
It's your contention then that the trial court did in fact enumerate sufficient facts?
Oh, clearly, Judge. I mean, even the Court of Appeals in this case said, oh, well, we accept the trial court. Obviously, this jury was confused and there was sufficient evidence to virtually order a directed verdict if the court had so inclined. However, simply the failure to comment on proximate cause and damages makes the trial court's comments insufficient for appellate review. It's our position that that simply isn't so. The state of the law is such that it was more than adequate to allow the appellate court to determine that a new trial was most appropriate. The facts in this case are so, the negligence and the proximate cause and the damage are so inextricably intertwined that to send it back to the trial court to comment on proximate cause and damages seems to us to be a vain act. The fact is that if all of the evidence was that the implants, the failure to remove the foam and the infected material and all of those things by Dr. Stanwell, the defendant in the case, that's so clear by all the expert testimony that that's below the standard of care, then as night follows day, it's like a case where we have foreign objects left in the body. I mean, the damages are presumed and the proximate cause is presumed because the subsequent surgeries are not only the natural consequence, but inevitable. And so to make somebody say that, to have the trial court be required to say that seems to be a vain act. And that's one of the reasons why we felt that sending it back to have the trial court say that is inappropriate in the case. He more than sufficiently articulated reasons for his decision.
It does seem to me that the Court of Appeals is being overly strict on requiring the trial court to say more than the trial court said here. Is the Court of Appeals, do you think the Court of Appeals' error here really is in its attempting to protect jury verdicts? We do that, as you know. We give great deference to verdicts of juries in our system. Do you think that's what's happening here with the Court of Appeals' opinion?
I can't say that, Judge, because I didn't get from their opinion they were really articulating that. I'm just not sure where that they once the trial judge makes up his mind or her mind to order the new trial, then the jury verdict and the quality of the jury verdict and the quality of the evidence supporting that verdict becomes inapposite. I mean, then the standard changes. Now we must determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to support the judge's decision. That is the test. And I think the Court of Appeals simply missed it. And as I said, I just can't explain why they did that in the face of their own cases and every other case that's been in every district, every reported case that we found.
You've suggested in your first proposition of law a statement that would be a statement of law if we adopted it. That doesn't seem to me that if we adopted it, this case seems very factually oriented, I guess, because we've got, obviously when a trial judge indicates why he or she is doing something, there are shadings or gradations, there are maybe fewer words or more words. And how do we write a principle of law that touches, your second proposition of law is pretty easy, whether we remand or not. But the first one, how do we write a precise rule of law that catches what your argument is here?
When a trial judge, in his or her exercise of discretion, articulates sufficient information, so sufficient reasons think it's already articulated. When they articulate sufficient information to provide an appeals court the opportunity to determine that that information supports his or her opinion to order a new trial, then there cannot be an abuse of discretion by that, which is where this standard came from. And again, my view was pulled out of the air. I just don't know where they got it. But I may not deserve the rest of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Michelson.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Perrelli. Perrella, excuse me.
Said the same thing. And Antel never said that we have to be specific or address causation. Just said, explain how you feel that the new trial should be granted. And that's it. We didn't say you had to cover causation or be specific.
I would say that if we're looking at this case, we're looking at a medical malpractice case. And this court in Brady versus Tatsumi stated the standard by which we review the medical malpractice cases, and proximate cause and damages are crucial elements of a medical malpractice case. In fact, the court said, before the plaintiff can recover, plaintiff must show by affirmative evidence, first, that the defendant was unskilled or negligent, and second, that his want of skill or care caused injuries to the plaintiff.
Is that to prove the merits of the case or to substantiate a motion for a new trial? They're clearly different standards, aren't they? You're talking about proving the merits of a malpractice case, aren't you, really? That's what Ratsuni talks about.
Ratsuni talks about the elements of a malpractice case.
Okay, and here we're talking about the elements, if you will, of a motion for new trial.
I would say that if you look to the court's early decision in CE Morris Company, this court said the judgment supported by some competent, credible evidence going to all the essential elements of the case will not be reversed by the Supreme Court as being against the manifest weight of the evidence. So at least in that case, this honorable court had articulated its reasoning that if there's evidence given as to all the essential elements of the case, the case would not be reversed as being against the manifest weight of the evidence. A crucial element in this case is proximate cause. You're speaking of a young lady who had numerous problems with breast tissue. She had 22 cysts. She had multiple surgeries, surgery by general surgeons, surgeries by my client, follow-up surgeries by Dr. Shaw. She had tumors.
Sounds to me like you want, for a motion for new trial, a court to actually show that the whole case was tried, all the elements were tried. And if that's the case, why grant a new trial? You could have just granted a directed verdict. If you have to prove every one of the underlying elements in the malpractice case in a motion for new trial, there would be no reason to have a new trial because it's already been proven. Wouldn't that be right?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
Would you? Okay, tell me why. And while you're doing it, think about it. It just occurred to me. Equate it to a summary judgment. Do you have to, on a summary judgment motion, prove the underlying case and all the elements to either defeat or get a motion for summary judgment?
You have to establish that there's no genuine issue of material fact.
Right, no genuine issue of material fact. No, that there is a genuine issue of material facts to get to defeat a summary judgment motion.
Right.
Okay. And at this point, you don't have to prove your whole case then, do you? Isn't a motion for a new trial like that?
I would equate a motion for a new trial with a summary judgment.
Okay.
Motion. I would say that if we look to this court in Pavlonis versus Valentine, this court has recognized that the jury system is engrafted upon the government by its fundamental law and has been employed by civilized nations to the period in which history has no record. In this case, the jury had reviewed the evidence in a week-long trial. They rendered a verdict for the defendant, and our argument and our position is that the judge clearly abused his discretion when he looked only to the negligence aspect without discussing the or the standard of care aspect without discussing the proximate cause and damages. And under Antel, we would look at a case by case basis. Itself does not give trial judges an unbridled discretion to order a new trial. And in Antel, the court stated that review by the court is ordinarily limited to the reasons specified in the trial court's order.
So we can't merely assume what is not delineated in the order that the judge reviewed proximate cause and damages. I'd like to reserve the remaining time if I may.
Well, you don't, happily, you don't have rebuttal time. So you better finish. Tell us everything you want to tell us now.
I would say that you must look to the Court of Appeals decision. Opposing counsel cited the Winton case, but in the Winton case, no basis for the trial court's decision was articulated by the trial court. So this case is different than the Winton case that was before the Court of Appeals. In the Winton case, as an ANSA, there were no specific reasons. In this case, as opposed to ANSA, the court did articulate reasons. However, we would argue that those reasons were not specific and did not provide a reasonable basis for the trial court's decision. The court said even when the appellate court said even when this court reviews evidence favorably as to the trial court's decision, by stopping short of a complete medical malpractice analysis, the question of whether the verdict in favor of Dr. Sandell was due to the media's inability to prove causation remains unanswered. The court is unable to completely evaluate the trial court's determination that the jury created a manifest injustice when it returned the verdict in favor of Dr. Sandell. They rejected opposing counsel's argument that the standard of the trial court, when focusing on the standard of care, implicitly found causation and said that in the end, implication is not enough. I would also state that in response to whether or not our own experts found that our client breached the standard of care, Dr. Wendell stated that Dr. Sandell should have removed the phone that convinced Cena felt, and at least in the second surgery, Dr. Sandell testified upon direct examination that he could not, that he did look for and did not see any foam. And that's on page 472 of the transcript. When you removed the breast prosthesis on October 2nd, 1990, did you think the area within the prosthesis was placed? Yes. And did you find any foam lining following your urethane foam lining? I could not find any follow-up urethane foam lining, no, sir. And did you look for it? Yes. So, at least as far as the standard of care, Dr. Sandell did look for and did not, in fact, locate any polished urethane foam lining in the October 2nd, 1990s. I would close by stating that the appellate court did not expand in the Ansel versus Old World Products doctrine and case law. It barely reviewed the trial court's order as it was supposed to. The trial court's order did not address causation and damages. And in the Ansel, looking at this case on a case-by-case basis, this court should affirm the appellate court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Perella. Mr. Michelson, you saved a little over 5 minutes of your time.
Try not to use it all.
Thank you, Mike.
In our view, there are two principles which you start with from the beginning. One is that the wide discretion is to be given to the trial court. We have the Osler case which says, this court has said, wide discretion is given to the trial court on these issues. Second, that there is a presumption of regularity which is to flow to the benefit of the trial judge taking a decision to order a new trial. So we presume regularity. That's the Jenkins case, and we reverse that only when there is a clearly erroneous conclusion by the trial court. Now, that can't be said in this case, given his statements and his description of the state of the evidence. Certainly he's the one that is most able to review that because of his participation in the trial. And Tell simply says, you must articulate the reason. This judge did articulate the reason. And I go back again to our discussion regarding the inevitability of the proximate cause of an attack with this type of injury. I don't think we should ignore that factual context that you have here. And it's probably unnecessary for this court to articulate a whole new rule. I mean, I think you've got the rules, and given the facts of this case, we are well situated to reinstate the trial court's decision and order the new trial.
I'm glad to hear you. I think you're clarifying the question I asked earlier. This is not really a case in which we state any new issue of law. It's really an error case, is it not? That's your argument, is that the Court of Appeals erred what it said that the trial court abused its discretion.
Yes, sir. I agree. We do not need a whole new statement of law here. And finally, I think what the Court of Appeals has done and the appellees in this case, they have ignored the concept of the trial judge. Case after case talks about this throughout history. They are the gatekeepers. They must protect against improper jury verdicts. They are the most properly situated to do that. They are the most competent to do that. And case after case, the appellate courts say we must afford that wide discretion to those judges because they're there and that's their purpose. And they have an obligation to do that, as he did here. And that is when there's an improper verdict, when it's against the manifest weight of the evidence, you cannot let it stand. During the new trial, depending on the state of the evidence, perhaps a different result will occur, perhaps not. But at least the next jury will have an opportunity to do the right thing. The defendant's arguments in this case appear to be irreconcilable. The first argument is they support the Court of Appeals. He didn't articulate sufficiently to allow appellate review. And then the second argument is, but he articulated sufficiently so that we can send it back, and we don't even need a remand to allow him to articulate. And this seems to be
Mr. Michelson, in your mind, does the statement manifest weight of the evidence, can it include proximate cause?
It can. Should that be?
Not always, but it could. It can.
Should that be the primary issue that the judge is looking at? But in this case, we're talking about the negligence. He addresses the negligence, which is the first issue that they reach. But in our view, in this case, proximate cause and damage are so integrally entwined with the negligence issue because of the nature of it, that he didn't reach that. There's a presumption that he reached probable cause, and he looked at it, and he says, well, as I said, nice follow-up thing. You leave something in somebody's body, you presume proximate cause and damage because you have to do a subsequent surgery. And that's what happened in this case. There's no... It's simply that he didn't leave it in the body because he forgot about it. He left it in the body because he ignored it. As a practical matter.
I didn't see the term res ipsa locator used here by either anybody. Is that it's not a res ipsa locator case?
I think it's a res ipsa case, but I think it's analogous to the foreign body cases. I think that makes sense. We'll get it that time. If there's nothing else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.